Here's another podcast we think you'll love. It's called Subtitle, and it tells stories about languages and the people who speak them. In each episode, Subtitle will take you to a country or a comedy show or a research lab, wherever there's a story about words and language. How do other languages deal with she, he, and they pronouns? Do bilingual people really think differently when they switch languages? Is there a connection between our very first words and our last ones? Subtitle has stories on all these questions. One recent episode profiles a woman who forgot her mother tongue and then set out to rediscover it. Another is about words like jiggly and puffball that seem programmed to make us laugh. And the latest episode, published March 6, is about the Irish language, a language that was suppressed for hundreds of years by English colonists. Talk about linguistic discrimination! And yet, Irish has survived. You'll hear from several people, native speakers and learners, about how the Irish language feels like a central part of their identity. Subtitle is produced in association with the Linguistic Society of America and is hosted by award-winning journalists Patrick Cox and Kavita Pillay. Listen at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this.
Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries Podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. Hey, Carrie, how's it going?
Well, you know, it's all right.
Yes, it's spring here. It's totally spring here. It's Oh, it's daylight savings time, so we're on the same hour of the day
again. Yeah. Meanwhile, it's like another winter here. Well, so I think it's warmer again, but like this last week, it was winter again. It was snowing on Wednesday. It's like, what is happening?
Huh? So the groundhog was wrong. Actually, I don't know what the groundhog said this year.
He said it was going to be a short winter, but at least most of them did. But I don't know if we have one in BC. And I just kind of feel like, obviously, they're fake. But if we had one, it would BC is just different. Especially Vancouver is different from the rest of Canada and like the East Coast. So
you would need a local groundhog to tell you. you can't trust the East Coast groundhog.
Yeah, I mean, we always get spring way earlier here, so.
So no, like, cherry blossoms yet?
Nope.
That's too bad. Those are so beautiful.
They are beautiful, but actually it's kind of good if it's a little bit later. Like, late March, early April is good, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we keep getting springs earlier and earlier here. It's not exactly good.
No, it's not. So, speaking of things that are not good.
Oh, what a transition. Okay, I'm ready. I think I'm ready.
I had not heard of this, and I can't believe that I hadn't heard of this. But according to NBC News.
Okay.
This is the headline. Trump warns of, quote, languages coming into our country that, quote, nobody has heard of.
What?
You haven't heard this either, hey?
No.
I love the way this man's brain works. Like, I'm sorry, no one's ever heard this language. A. Ooh. What? B. Even if that's true, how is that a thing to be scared of? How is that not a thing to be like, oh, cool, I want to learn more?
Yeah, I mean, that just speaks to, they're so afraid of the other. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think he's actually afraid. He just likes to stoke the fear, but.
That's true. Yeah. He likes to stoke the fear for others who are truly afraid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just, anthropomorphizing language like that is also very hilarious.
That's true. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. Because I automatically just think of the speakers, but you're right. He's, like, acting as though these languages are traveling by themselves.
Right. Like, they have their, their little luggage, you know, it's fine. Just making their way across Mexico into the U.S., yeah. I definitely have an image in my head that is comical, but, I mean, truly, this is not comical. I mean, this is terrible. And people are going to, his fans are going to, now they're worried about that, you know, because he said it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. You're going to just believe it. Okay, so let me tell you the whole, well, this is probably not the whole quote, because his quotes are always, like, polished for the newspapers in ways that are completely unfair, but, okay.
quote, we have languages coming into our country. We don't have one instructor in our entire nation that can speak that language. There are these are languages. It's the craziest thing. They have languages that nobody in this country has ever heard of. It's a very horrible thing.
Not one instructor. Just because he hasn't heard of these languages doesn't mean other people haven't heard of these languages, is what I'm hearing.
A. B. Who cares if there's an instructor to teach it or not?
Right.
Irrelevant.
Right. I mean, the thing that I think of is, like, I'm sad because what if, you know, like, the thing about the interpretation and courts and stuff, and, like, you know, there are not enough people to do that kind of stuff when it comes to underserved languages.
Of course, there are legitimately languages where there's nobody who can do the translation for. Like, yeah, that's why often they're, like, forced to switch to, like, a major language like Spanish or, like, a variety of Arabic or whatever, like, something else. But, yeah, like, that is a legitimate concern that we can't really address. Like, if someone doesn't know it well enough to translate or interpret, then that just is, right? But right. So that is bad, but... That's not what he means at all.
He doesn't care about that part. No. That's not what he cares about.
In fact, he's happy if they can't get services. That's fine for him.
Yeah. And that's part of his agenda, actually, for them not to get services.
Yeah. He also called them truly foreign languages, which is interesting because...
Interesting.
Yeah. Like, it really goes to show that the word foreign is obviously problematic in all sorts of different ways, but
yeah
like he knows that Spanish is not actually like foreign,
right,
any more than English is. Either both are or neither are,
right? He might even know that about indigenous languages. He might
I don't think he thinks about it at all, but
no nor would he say
no
but no. But yeah, the fact that he put that truly in front of foreign does goes to show that, yeah.
He knows something. Here's another quote. So as he's addressing a rally in Virginia, Trump described New York classrooms as overwhelmed with, quote, pupils from foreign countries, from countries where they don't even know what the language is.
What? Okay, that... I don't... Does he know what he means by that? Sometimes is what I have to ask.
I feel like what he thinks he means is that I bet he's like Somalian. What even is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or South Sudan. Who knows what language they speak there? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's what I think he means. Like, he doesn't know what the language is.
Right.
Therefore, nobody does.
Right. Because he is the knower of all things.
The narcissism on this man,
it's unprecedented.
It is impressive. I know we overuse that word, but for him, it's just, it applies. He's a narcissist through and through.
And I know we overuse the word unprecedented, but I also think that it fits here.
It really does. I don't know. This is so funny to me and also horrifying at the same time.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's, I can't believe I didn't hear that before now.
No, I missed it entirely, but I don't know, man. Whatever news I'm getting is just, I don't know, it's different. Like, I'm finding out all of the airplane things. Like, who wants to fly now? Right. I never liked flying, and now I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know if I can get another flight. These planes Ever are again? Falling apart.
They really are falling apart. Quality is going down. Capitalism.
Okay. So this is something capitalism, yes. Here's another part. So NBC News says it's not entirely clear what languages Trump is referencing. When asked to clarify Trump's remarks, campaign spokesman Stephen Chung responded, quote, there are migrants invading from countries that we know nothing about, which is the point. What?
Which is the point of what? Also, the idea that we don't know anything about the countries that they're coming from?
That's impossible.
Yeah.
No. I'm sorry. The U.S. Intelligence Service knows everything, or not everything, knows a lot about all countries around the world.
Right. Even a lay person or a civilian can find out a lot of information.
A lot of things. Yeah, you can find a lot of things. I mean, like, the information coming out of North Korea is patchy, but you can find out some stuff, right?
Right.
Like, yeah.
Right. But the government definitely has access to more
information than we do. Yeah, they know a lot. Yeah, a lot more than we do. And, like, I'm sure they may be interpreting it with a certain lens or whatever, but there's information.
Right. Just the idea. I mean, they doubled down. His spokesperson doubled down, basically.
Kind of. He kind of tried to, like, say, well, we don't really know much about these countries. That's what he really means. He's not talking about the languages. But no, dude, he was talking about the languages.
He was really talking about the languages.
Maybe he meant the country, but I don't know. That doesn't make it better. It makes it sound like he's a little bit not all there now, which is also possible.
That's definitely possible. It wouldn't be surprising.
Anyway, I know I shouldn't be laughing because this is actually horrific. What he's planning on doing if he takes over again is like turning it into a dictatorship. He's even said it, like, dictatorship for a day, but come on, he means forever.
I know.
But I can't help it because it's so ludicrous. Like, sometimes, like, you have to laugh just to stop from crying.
No, I know. I mean, at least you're in Canada. Although, what we do here affects you. I know it does.
It affects the entire world.
Yeah.
And Canada may be the most just because of how close we are, like, proximity-wise, but also, like, I'm pretty sure we're each other's greatest trading partner.
And Mexico. Just Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., aren't they all kind of...
Well, there's that agreement.
Right.
But we get most, I think, a fair chunk of our goods from the U.S., less from Mexico.
Okay, I see. Yeah. No, I know. It weighs on me heavily. I think that it doesn't weigh on me, but I know it does, so...
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's this cloud that's, like, that's hovering over our heads. Like, or a sword of Damocles, right? Like, we're just... we lived under it for 4 years.
I know.
And then there was, like, the lead up to it, which was over a year, right? Like, him coming up down that escalator.
Yep.
Everything from that point. Dark. Yep.
Dark. Darkness.
And then Biden comes in and, like, alleviates some of it, but not all of it.
Yeah. Because all of his fans has gotten a taste of the Trump, whatever he's selling. And they like it.
And it's still
around.
Yeah, I mean, fascism doesn't just go away. Fascists are love fascism, so.
Yeah. And they hate things like truly foreign languages.
Languages where there's not one single instructor. What a bizarre way of thinking about it.
It really is.
So as long as there's a single instructor, that makes it okay? I don't know. His brain, man, it's fascinating to me.
That's one way to think about it.
That's the only way I have to intellectualize it. Otherwise, it's just truly too terrifying.
Yeah. Well, at least we have a fun episode today.
Yeah, the episode is great. I'm sorry for this.
The darkness.
The darkness beforehand.
We hope you enjoy.
Yes.
So today we are so excited to have Anne Curzan, who is the Geneva Smitherman Collegiate Professor of English, Linguistics, and Education, and an Arthur F. Thurnau Professor at the University of Michigan, where she also currently serves as the Dean of the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. She has a new book called Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Anne.
It is my pleasure. I really love the work that you both are doing.
We appreciate that. And we appreciate the work that you're doing. You have a radio show too, right?
I do. I have a short radio segment every Sunday morning on Michigan Public, which is the radio station here in Ann Arbor in Southeast Michigan and other places in Michigan, where I share random linguistic information 5 minutes at a time.
It's amazing. That's a good amount of time to get people to get into linguistics.
It's been great. And we've been doing it now for 12 years.
Wow.
And I had a listener a couple years ago say to me, you know, I listen to you every Sunday morning and I realize that what you're really telling me is that I could chill out about language a little bit.
Yes.
And I love that because I thought that's actually exactly what I'm saying without ever saying it. I'm talking about language change. I'm talking about variation in language. Where do these rules come from? A little bit at a time. And I love that she over time was like, huh, I think you're telling me I could just relax.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, I think a lot of people get really stressed out about language, especially, you know, usage rules. Why did you want to write this book and why now?
I love both parts of that question. Why this book and why now? This book is a passion project for me. I've been working on this and teaching this material most of my career, which is at this point 25 years as a faculty member. I'm a linguist who lives in an English department. So I study the history of English. I study change over time, diversity in English and all its varieties across the country and the world. I'm also a professor in a department where we have the writing program and students are coming to learn how to master conventions of academic writing. So I've been balancing these hats, my linguist hat and my, at various times, director of the writing program hat. And I have wanted to write this book to help people think about how we could move away from straightforward ideas of right and wrong in language, which as linguists, we know is not a particularly linguistically accurate or useful way to think about language. And instead, we could think about more and less effective ways to use language based on context and audience and purpose, recognizing that we use language in a whole variety of ways, which may be more and less helpful depending on context. So it allows us to talk about repertoires. And the bigger your repertoire, the more effective a speaker and writer you can be. As to why now, I've been working on this book for about 8 years. I became the dean during those 8 years. And this has been this project that I love turning to in what I sometimes call magic time, the time that does not really exist, but that you find anyway, because it has brought me such joy to work on. And I'm thrilled to have it done and coming out.
That makes me feel better about how long our book is taking.
Yeah, COVID happened too, right? So that was kind of hard for everyone.
That's absolutely right. COVID happened 6 months into my deanship.
Oh, wow. Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah. Well, I love the title. You use the word funner in the title, a word that some people would actually argue isn't a word. Why did you want to do that?
I did it as you guess. It's very intentional that funner is in the title, both to provoke perhaps a little bit of people's inner grimando, and we can come back to the term grimando.
Yes.
But also their curiosity about what is a usage guide that has funner in the title? What's going on here? And of course, it goes with the first part of the title, says who? Says who that funner isn't a word or that there's something wrong with that? And then there's a chapter in the book called The Funnest Chapter. That's where I talk about the history of fun as well as other issues around comparatives and superlatives. And what I really love about the example of fun is it shows how the rules can sometimes struggle to account for language change. So if you don't mind, while we're here, we could talk about the history of fun.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it is, so to speak, fun. Just had to go there. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
But fun, for much of its life in English, was a noun. And as a noun, if there was more fun, you said more fun in the same way that you would say more water. One can imagine then how, if children heard a sentence such as the party was fun, they might think that in that sentence, fun is an adjective. Their parents might have meant it as a noun in the same way that we could say the party was chaos. But the kid hears the party was fun and they think, well, that sounds like the party is boring or the party is terrific. Fun is an adjective, at which point the kid can also say the party was very fun. That was a fun party because now fun is an adjective. So if fun is an adjective, kids, as they're learning language, are figuring out the rules, these descriptive rules that are part of our knowledge, and they look at the way other one-syllable adjectives work, which is that they typically take ER to form the comparative and EST to form the superlative. Tall, taller, tallest, short, shorter, shortest, wide, wider, widest, fun. Here we go. Funner, funnest. And that's, of course, why you hear kids create that construction until their parents or some other adult authority figure corrects them and says, no, 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 it's not funner. That sounds terrible. It's more fun, at which point they categorize that as an exception to this rule, because there are, of course, always exceptions. Now, I think that in the long run, the kids are going to win, as they usually do. And what I'm seeing happen here is that when I poll undergraduates as well as older speakers, they don't mind funnest as much as they mind funner.
Okay.
Funnest, some people have a negative reaction, but they say, it's not as bad. There was an iPod commercial years ago, the funnest iPod ever. It's out there in the language and people aren't having a strong reaction to it. So my guess is that funnest will become more and more standard and funner will scoot in on its coattails.
I noticed that in myself actually just now, like you were talking about the chapters named the funnest chapter, and it didn't bug me at all, but funner, yeah, I do notice it.
Right. And I think that's such a great example of the way in which we also learn our peeves. Because, of course, there's nothing badly constructed about funner. It works just like taller. And when people say, I just don't like the sound of it, I often ask, well, how do you feel about the word runner? And they say, well, runner is fine. And I say, but they rhyme. It's an acquired distaste.
For sure. Just like I think the acquired distaste for moist.
One of the most hated words in the English language.
It's true.
I know. I'm glad it doesn't bug me because it really seems to upset people. So let's go back to the grammandos and wordies. You make that distinction. So what is the distinction and why is that important?
Grammando, which is a word I really like. I want to credit Lizzie Skernick, New York Times Sunday Magazine. She has a little piece called That Should Be a Word. And in 2012, she featured grammando. And a grammando is someone who corrects other people's grammar. And I saw this and I completely agreed that should be a word because it gives us a better term than grammar Nazi, which I have never liked. I think if we're going to talk about Nazis, then we'll talk about Nazis, which is a very serious thing to talk about. And if we're going to talk about people correcting each other's grammar, let's have a more playful term for that. And grammando seems like a great one. And it also gives you the phrase to go grammando on someone, which I just think is a delightful phrase. So you have grammandos, people who are correcting other people's grammars, and then wordy, which is a relatively new word. You can now find it in Merriam-Webster online and other places. And it's typically defined as a lover of words, which I know the three of us are.
Absolutely.
Lovers of words. And I would actually make the argument humans love words. It's why your podcast is so terrific, is that people are curious about language, languages they speak or other languages that they hear and are curious about. We also enjoy language. Think about how many people are playing Wordle in the morning or spelling bee or enjoy punning. This is all pleasure in language. One of the breakthroughs for me in writing the book, and it's always fun when you get breakthroughs writing a book.
Yeah, absolutely.
I haven't quite thought about this way before, was to recognize that I think each one of us in our head has an inner wordy, that part of you that really enjoys language, and an inner grammando that hears things and feels unhappy about them. And even the three of us, trained as linguists, very descriptive approach to language. Language change keeps me in business. I'm fascinated by it. And yet I will sometimes hear things that are new in the language. And my little inner grammando says, seriously, does the language have to change that way? I don't like that.
Yep. Do you think that's because of institutions like school that we all have our inner grammando?
That is certainly a big piece of it. For most of us, part of our education was learning a set of rules, what we would call prescriptive rules about language, about what is right and what is wrong, what is correct or incorrect, or good and bad in the use of language. And it was presented to us in most cases as a very naturalized part of language. I did not have any exposure to more descriptive approaches until I went to college. There was no discussion of how do dialects work? How do kids learn language? in elementary school, junior high school, high school, you're learning a little bit of physics, a little bit of chemistry. You're getting this descriptive approach to a lot of the sciences and social sciences. But when it comes to language, it's this very prescriptive, this is what's right and this is what is wrong. So it becomes very naturalized for us, I think, to see that there are right and wrong ways. I think another factor is just that we can sometimes have negative reactions to things that are new or unfamiliar in life in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would guess both of you have examples. It cracks me up when I hear my inner Gramando get all upset about things. A recent example was double click as a verb to mean to dive deeper into something.
Oh, I would not use it that way.
It's pretty business jargony. I think I gave a talk the other day in a business setting and I gave this example and they said, oh, we all use double click that way. I encountered it with a colleague of mine in the business school, and it was the way that he transitioned between slides. So you'd have a slide with three different bullet points, and then he would say, okay, let's double click on the first idea. And that would be the transition to the next slide. And I would sit in these presentations and feel cranky about this bit of business jargon and think, this is just ridiculous and so business schooly. And I came home one night and I was telling my partner about this use of double click and how jargony it was. And he looked at me and he said, I actually think it's quite clever.
It is, yeah.
And I thought, of course it is. It actually is poetic. It's kind of a great metaphorical use of it. And I have subsequently calmed down my inner Gramando about it. And I think that that's what in the book I'm trying to do is help each of us have these conversations with our inner Gramando before that correction comes out of your mouth. To sort of say, wait a minute, why am I feeling so cranky? Am I justified in this? Do I need to say this out loud at this moment? Is that a good thing to do? Or could I think more like a wordy? And one of the analogies that I came up with in writing the book was we could think of your inner wordy like a bird watcher. And if a bird watcher is out there looking for new birds and then you see a new bird, you should be curious about the new bird and try to describe the new bird as opposed to kill the new bird.
Right.
But with language, we often hear a new thing and our reaction can be, we got to make that stop.
Kill it with fire.
Yeah.
A lot of the business jargon usually gets under my craw, but this one, even though at first I was like, what? It is clever. I actually like it now.
I do too. I wonder if it's going to expand to different areas.
Oh, I would guess it will, because the idea of digging deeper into something is something that crosses lots of contexts. And one of the things that I really love about being a historian of the English language, which gets to this business jargon question, is that I study both how language changes over time, or how the English language has changed over time, and how attitudes about what is right and wrong change over time. And what I love about that is it helps give us perspective on the things that we're feeling cranky about now, because we can go back in time and see what people were feeling cranky about 50, 100, 200 years ago, and they look quaint and silly. And I often say, we're going to look just as quaint and silly 50 or 100 years from now. And an example in the business jargon space is finalize. These I-Z-E verbs, when they come in, often create a lot of anxiety and angst and anger. Finalize, in the 1960s, people latched onto that as business jargon. They really didn't like it. The American Heritage Usage Panel pretty soundly condemned it in the late 1960s. We can come back to that usage panel. But as the panel kept getting surveyed over the decades, you watched more and more of the panel except finalize. And at this point, almost the whole panel says there's absolutely nothing wrong with finalize because it doesn't even sound jargony to us anymore. And I
not at all.
Sometimes show students that usage note and I say, that is the sound of a peeve dying.
Oh, I love it.
This totally gets to our next question. You're already hitting on it. As a historian of the English language, what insights do you in particular bring to the task of writing a usage guide?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of main points that I'm trying to help people see as part of thinking about usage. One is the English language is always changing, like every living language, and that looks much cooler to us in retrospect than it does now. When we look at changes in the past, such as the word nice used to mean silly, or lollygag used to mean to mess around in the kissing sense of mess around.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I know. We think that's so interesting. Or the fact that double and multiple negation was standard in all varieties of English. People say, that is just really interesting. And then you say, look, by accident is giving way to on accident if you listen to how young people speak. And people say, that is terrible. That is the destruction of the English language. And I say, it's actually not. It's language change. It's part of a living language. That is one of the first key points that I bring as a historian of the language. A second one is, as we've been talking about, that notions of right and wrong are not nearly as straightforward as we were taught in school. And that is both because we can look over time to see that what was considered wrong or right 50, 100, 200 years ago has now changed, and what was right is now wrong, or wrong is now right, or no one notices anymore. That is a key part of that. But also, even just in the present, and this is where I put on my English professor hat, people don't agree about what is right or wrong, or what is a quote unquote mistake, because people have learned different rules, or people care deeply about different rules. So you'll have one English professor who feels that it is wrong to use hopefully to mean it is hoped. And you'll have another English professor who didn't learn about that or doesn't care. And students are trying to navigate this obstacle course among faculty where they're like, what are people going to care about, and what is right and what is wrong? So one of the things I'm trying to help people think about in the book is that we could allow more variation in the language than many usage guides tend to allow.
Who do you hope, whose hands this book will get into most of all?
It's such a good question, because I am hoping that this usage guide will reach both emerging writers, students, people who are trying to hone those skills as speakers and as writers. I'm also hoping that the gatekeepers are going to read this book. And often we place the burden on writers,
right,
or speakers. And we say, you just have to learn to navigate this obstacle course and figure out what people's peeves are and work your way through it and avoid the peeves. And to some extent, that is true. It's part of being a savvy writer is thinking about, what are the expectations of this audience? How do I want to navigate that? But I want the gatekeepers to be much more accepting of change and variation, because this is where discrimination comes in. And it's why I'm so thrilled to be on your podcast, where you all focus on this in all of your episodes, because language is such a powerful gatekeeper. And the gatekeepers are often not well informed about where a rule came from, whether it was well-founded to begin with, what's happening in the language, what are writers and readers and speakers doing in this space? And that's what I hope this book will help address.
Well, it absolutely does. With your historical perspective on where these rules are coming from, it's very, very helpful.
I want to go back to the on accident and by accident thing. I actually don't think it's just young people, because Megan's generation definitely has on accident.
I know. I say on accident.
I feel like my generation, Gen X, is the last of the by accidents.
Yeah.
So we're talking people in their 40s now are on accident users.
Yes. And of course, from my perspective, those are all younger.
Yeah. Still young people.
Younger, but not young.
Yeah. And what I like about this example, too, is that many older speakers notice it. When I poll undergraduates, I will get a mixture of by accident and on accident speakers, including young people who use both forms. And usually more than half of them have never noticed it until I brought it up, that it's variation living below the level of consciousness. And it's not until I say something that they think, oh, yeah, I could use both.
Yeah, because it's definitely, I notice it.
You notice when I say on accident?
You or anybody. I've noticed it on TV a lot more recently. It's, I think, become the norm now at this point. I'm the old fuddy-duddy.
And it's, again, such a good example of noticing it. And I also notice it. I'm a by accident speaker, and I notice on accident speakers. Who knows, in another 10, 15 years, I may not even notice anymore. But right now, Carrie, I would guess you and I don't say anything about it.
No, God, no.
Well, right. But this was first brought to my attention by parents 10, 15 years ago, who came to me to say, what is happening with this on accident thing, and make it stop.
make it stop because you have that power.
Yeah, okay, sure.
I'll get right on that.
They were also doing that with the new verb verse to mean to play against.
Oh, yeah. Was that relatively new?
It's relatively new from everything I can tell, and it is a wonderful example of back formation. These parents would come to me all angry about it, and then I was very disappointing because I said, that is so cool. That's such a creative back formation by young people.
Right.
Where I think they've taken versus the Latin preposition and reinterpreted V-E-R-S-U-S as V-E-R-S-E-S. If you hear something like, tonight, the thunder versus the heat.
Yeah.
It sounds a lot like the thunder plays the heat, in which case verse is a verb that means play against, at which point you can be versing people and have versed them.
I had heard that verb, but it's not part of my normal life at all. Like, I haven't heard it in years. I hope it's surviving because it's really cool.
I think it is.
I agree. It seems to be thriving. I think it's here to stay. One could say it's a nice, concise shortcut for play against.
Yeah.
You can just say verse.
I have it. I don't have the versing. Like, you can reversing people. Do people use that? Have you heard?
Uh-huh.
Very cool.
Because once it's a verb, it can have the present participle, the past participle. It's out there for young people who have it as a verb. There it is.
Awesome. This actually dovetails really nicely with our next question, which is, why do people have such strong feelings about what is or is not allowed to be counted as a word? And when someone says a word isn't real, what are they really saying?
I have been fascinated by this question for years. When people say, is that a word, or that's not a real word? And I was just looking at it with a new peeve that crossed my radar in the last couple of weeks, which is training as a countable noun.
Oh, okay.
In other words, training to mean a training session, at which point it can be made plural and you can have three trainings this month. Someone asked me about it as to, is it okay? And I went online looking at the guidance about it, and I found this site that said, training as a countable is not a word. Now, of course, it is a word because we all know what it means. And a word is a word if it conveys meaning to other people. It has conventional accepted use. And if I said my company's offering three trainings this month about that, we would all just nod and on we would go. So of course it's a word. I think what people mean is either it is not or I don't think it is in a standard dictionary. Now, of course, dictionary editors would say, we're just trying to keep up with all of you, and we can never keep up as you all change the language. So you're changing the language. We're trying to record that. But dictionary editors are also trying to make sure that they don't record something that turns out to be only a short-lived fad in the language and dies. They're waiting to see what the shelf life of this new use is. So they'll never be fully on top of the most current changes. The landscape has also, of course, changed with online dictionaries, which can be updated faster. The print dictionaries really couldn't keep up with us,
right?
Because it took a while to update them. But what's interesting to me also about a word like training is that I went into the Oxford English Dictionary to look at what's the history of that. And you can find the countable use of training back into the 1500s. It started in the military, then it spreads from there. It has been longstanding. But if you look at the Google Books Ngram Viewer, one of my favorite toys.
So fun.
So fun. Has some weaknesses to it, but very fun for overall trends. If you search for trainings as a plural, you see that over the last 20 to 25 years, it has shot up in usage. In other words, it is fashionable, and that's why people are now noticing it. Even though it's been in use for hundreds of years, it suddenly is everywhere, and people are saying, wait a minute, can you really do that? I think the other thing that's worth noticing is that I still screw it up sometimes, but I've tried to say, I don't think people think it's not in a standard dictionary. What we often say is people don't think it's in the dictionary.
Right.
And I will catch myself using that phrase, but there's no such thing as the dictionary, as the three of us know. There are many dictionaries with different philosophies. They were published at different dates. Some of them are more general dictionaries, some are unabridged, some are collegiate, some are specialized. So there's also some material in the book trying to unpack how do dictionaries work, because dictionaries are actually fascinating resources once you unpack the history of them and the human hands involved in creating them.
That's an important point, that there are human hands that are in creating them. And do you think that that plays into what people were really saying when they say a word isn't real? Is it getting to the fact that there are still human gatekeepers in these things and they are trying to keep up with us? But if we don't find it in the dictionary at a certain point when someone looks at it, then we're kind of like, see, told you.
Yeah, I think we have been educated to trust that there are language authorities out there who are empowered to tell us what is right and what is wrong, what is and what isn't a word. That is what's behind my title of the book, which is Says Who, that we should be asking questions when someone says that's just not right or that's not a word, that it's okay to say, who said that? Where does that rule come from? It doesn't mean that it's not a useful rule, but we should ask, is it a useful rule? Where does it come from? Does it actually make me a more effective writer, or does it hinder my ability to be an effective speaker or writer? And with dictionaries, I love pulling back that curtain and saying, do you think the dictionary editors were right on this one? And dictionary editors are comfortable with that. They know that they are doing the best that they can to capture what a word means in a very concise way, knowing that words will surpass our ability to explain their meaning in a short definition, and that they also will change. And so we are allowed to challenge those definitions. One of the exercises that I do in class with students is look at words that might have usage labels like slang or offensive or informal, colloquial, vulgar slang. And I take out all the usage labels, leave the definitions, and I ask them to decide what usage label they would put on a word. Is it informal or slang? Is it offensive? Is it vulgar? And they work through it and they say, these decisions are really hard. And then I will share what the editors of a dictionary have done, the one that I've taken the examples from, and they often disagree. And they will say, wait a minute, what do you mean they have no usage label there? That word is offensive and it should have a usage label. And I say, the editors had to make very human decisions, and they may not have captured the way you think about this word or the way that this word has changed over time. And what I like is that students come out of that thinking about dictionaries in very different ways. Not that they aren't incredibly valuable resources, because they are. Good dictionaries are phenomenal and erudite and an incredible resource for all of us, but they're human.
I think people really forget that they're human ultimately.
And that's what we see in the phrase, the dictionary.
Yeah.
Or when I started working on this years ago, I realized, wow, when you walk into, for example, a university library, one of the first things you often see is a big unabridged dictionary on a pedestal, framed as this place where you go to get answers. And rarely can you see, unless you really flip all the way to the front, to see, you know, what dictionary is this? When was it published? It's just there as this old, longstanding authority on language. But of course, if it's at least 10, 15, 20 years old, it's probably already out of date with words that are on the move.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So you cover a lot of different kinds of rules in your book. Do you want to talk about your favorite one that either you enjoy using or that you like breaking?
Well, the rule that I probably feel most strongly about is about singular they. I have very strong feelings about Oxford commas too, and we can come back to that. But singular they, I have been working on singular they since I was an undergraduate, actually. And we have seen so much change on this within our lifetimes, change that really is so exciting. To me, I wasn't sure I'd see it in my lifetime. I grew up, I'm old enough, that in junior high school and through a lot of high school, I was taught to use generic he.
Okay.
That it should be a teacher should learn his students' names because he encompassed all of us. And I will say, as someone who does not identify as he, I did not really feel like it encompassed me, but that's what I was taught was correct. And it wasn't until much later that I looked into the history of this rule. And it was really powerful for me to learn where this came from and also to understand the disjunct between the way we speak and what we've been taught to write down. If you look at the way we speak, almost all of us, including people who say that they do not like and do not use singular they, almost all of us actually do use singular they. You hear it in a sentence such as, Someone who knows where they're going should give us directions. Someone who knows where they're going, it's so invisible,
right?
It goes right by us. But someone is singular. There's that singular they for a person whose gender is unknown, irrelevant, not to be disclosed. That use goes back to at least the 1300s, singular they. The rule that we're supposed to use he rather than they goes back to the 18th century. We can find this idea that the masculine encompasses the feminine in those grammar books. And then it's Lindley Murray's grammar, 1795, that is incredibly influential in spreading this rule. And what's interesting to me is in that grammar book, he has a sentence with a singular they in it, and he crosses out the they and puts a he. So he knew what we wanted to say and write, and he crossed it out. He said, that's a he. And for 200 years, we lived with this rule that it was he as a generic. 1970s, you get second wave feminism pushing against this singular generic he very successfully, at which point we got the advice that you should use he or she. Ugh.
Isn't that your generation's, Carrie? Did you learn that growing up? He or she?
Mm-hmm. Which is okay as far as it gets you. It's clunky. It's also not inclusive. Not everyone identifies within the he, she binary. You got advice like you could alternate he and she between paragraphs, which to me is even worse. Very confusing. Or you could rewrite the whole thing so you don't need a pronoun, or you make the whole thing plural. And the question is, why can't we write down singular they? And that's been a shift in thinking for me. I used to get into debates with people about whether they could be singular. And I realized that this was not a good debate because it's actually not debatable. Someone would say to me, but they can't be singular. And I would say, but it is. And they would say, but it can't be. And I would say, but it is. If you look at the data, it is singular. When someone says, but a pronoun can't be singular and plural at the same time. Exactly. I think what an interesting argument to make about English, where you already have another pronoun, you, that functions as a singular and plural at the same time, with that plural verb are in both the singular and the plural. They've been doing this for hundreds of years. So the question is, why can't we write it down? And there is no good reason why we can't write singular they down. What I couldn't have predicted is that it would be singular non-binary they that would finally open the gates on this one. When the Washington Post changed its guidelines, and I think it was 2015, it was to allow for the use of singular non-binary they for people who don't identify as he or she as a signal of respect, a really important one to use people's pronouns. And then the generic use of singular they is going to get to scoot in behind the non-binary use of they, which is every way that we can use singular they in writing is good by me.
Yeah.
I am really thrilled to see this change happen. And I think the one fair argument that people make is that they, as a singular, can be ambiguous sometimes. And an example would be, I saw my mother and her friend and they said. So is that both of them said, or either the friend or your mother identifies as they and they said? That's ambiguous. But we could take the same sentence and say, I saw my mother and her friend and she said, and that would also be ambiguous because we don't know if it was your mother or her friend. Pronouns can be ambiguous. And if you're writing, you need to fix it so it's not ambiguous, but it's not inherent in they. That they is ambiguous and no other pronoun is ambiguous. It's to say pronouns can sometimes be ambiguous. And as an effective writer, you should clarify any potential ambiguity, no matter what pronoun it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Languages have whole strategies around topic tracking because, you're not sure who the pronoun is referring to.
Right. But if you don't like singular they, you'll use that as an argument to say we shouldn't write down singular they. The other argument you'll hear with non-binary singular they, because this one is relatively new, and if it is new to you, it can be hard to incorporate into your grammar. When you're referring to a specific person whose pronoun is they, people will say, I really struggle with that. And I say, well, okay, work on it. You will get used to it. Younger people in environments where they have a lot of peers who may use singular they as their pronoun look at us older speakers and say, why do you all find this so hard? It's really not that hard. But sometimes people will say to me, I think it's silly that someone has they as a pronoun. And that is a place where we're seeing discrimination in the language. And I want to catch it to say it's not silly. That is that person's pronoun. And the analogy that I came up with a few years ago that seems to help a little bit is with names. And I said, if someone said to you, my name is Michael, but I go by Paul. And you said, well, I'm going to call you Michael because that is easier for me. Or I'm going to call you Andy because that is easier for me. We would think that that was rude and odd as a response to someone saying, this is my name. And when someone says, this is my pronoun, you should call someone by their pronoun and not say, I'm sorry, it's easier for me to use some other pronoun.
Right.
It's respectful to use people's pronouns the same way it's respectful to use the names that they use.
And it's so simple. It's ultimately simple. Basic human decency.
I do think the singular they, the non-binary one, can be a little bit tricky for people. I don't want to be like, oh, it's so simple. The name is really simple. I think there's like the grammatical thing that just is a little bit tricky at first, but it's not insurmountable. You can do it.
Well, the idea of it's simple. The idea that you would want to do this for someone is simple, I believe. It couldn't be complicated to, you know, use it, but simple idea to want to respect someone.
I think that's a beautiful distinction right there of it's simple to want to respect people and to realize that using their pronouns is a way to respect them. And then for those of us who didn't grow up with singular they as a non-binary pronoun, it may take us some time to integrate it into our grammar and we may get it wrong sometimes. And then you apologize and you try to get it right. And that's what's been so interesting to me with my nieces and nephews who are young people and they've been in schools where non-binary they is a thing. They have peers who are using it. It's just part of their grammar. They don't even think about it. And they sometimes say to me, Anne, what is all the fuss about? I'm like, oh, there's a fuss.
What's all the fuss about is the perfect encapsulation of all of these.
It's true.
You brought up the Oxford comma. What are your thoughts on that?
I once had a student come up after class. I was teaching the history of English. And she said, Professor Curzian, do you have feelings about the Oxford comma? And I realized I really do have feelings about the Oxford comma. I like it. Do you both like it? Not like it?
I like it.
I'm indifferent. Sometimes I think it's necessary, but I don't think it's always necessary.
And that would be exactly right. There are times when it usefully disambiguates that if it's not there, you can get some ambiguity. And one of the points I try to make a few different times in the book is that one of the things that makes writing so hard, makes it harder than speaking, is that it cannot tolerate as much ambiguity as speech. That we're ambiguous all the time in speech because we have shared context a lot of the time. We also can see or someone will ask if they're confused and we can clarify. And in writing, you can't do that. And many of the rules that are out there, not all of them, but at least some of them, are designed to minimize ambiguity. And that can actually be helpful. And the Oxford comma can be helpful when it does that. I realized that I, in my appreciation of the Oxford comma, have fallen into the idea that either you always use the Oxford comma or you always don't use the Oxford comma, which is what most style guides will tell you, and different style guides will use it or not use it. Journalism tends not to use the Oxford comma because it's sparser on punctuation. But I have been pushing myself. I don't actually believe my own argument on this, but I'm trying to challenge my own thinking, which is you could use the Oxford comma when it is helpful and not use it when it is unnecessary. And it would be fine because we don't need as much consistency as style guides tell us that we need. I've been a copy editor for years, and I still at some level enforce that. But the linguist part of me is trying to push on. And do you have to be quite such a stickler about the consistency?
Yeah, I only enforce it if someone's using APA style or whatever styles require it. Otherwise, yeah, I just let whatever the authors do.
But I do it, for example, with data, where when I copy edit, I believe data can be both singular and plural because it can. If you look at usage, it is both singular and plural. But I came up with this rule for myself, which is that the author has to be consistent in the article. Either it's always singular in the article or it's always plural in the article. But again, just as a thought exercise, would it be that confusing to us if it was both singular and plural in the same article? Probably not. But at the same time, one could say, why risk distracting your readers by having the inconsistency?
With that one, for sure, I would find that jarring, I think. I'd be like, well, which one is it? Are you making a distinction? Like, should I think of a singular data as something different from the plural data? I don't know.
this is where I hope that we can get to as editors and writers, is not that plural data is correct and singular data is wrong, because that's not true. Data is becoming singular over time. But if it's shifting between singular and plural, will that be distracting to your readers? Is it going to raise questions like Carrie has of, wait, is there some distinction here that I'm missing? And then suddenly they're focused on the grammar as opposed to the content. So it could be worth editing to make sure people aren't distracted by it. That's different from saying, this is right and this is wrong.
Yes,
absolutely.
I agree. And I think I'm going to use that in my head because I do some editing for linguistic journals.
And you see both.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mess with that. But if it was inconsistent, I probably would choose one or the other. But yeah, for other kinds of similar questions, I'm going to ask that to myself. Like, does it matter?
I like that. Does it matter? What's the fuss about? What's the fuss about?
I'll just pop in that I think one of the other really important messages of the book, which resonates so much with your podcast, is that linguistic diversity is part of cultural diversity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so along with language change, really trying to help people understand that we all have different ways of speaking as part of the diversity of us. And that as we seek to create fully inclusive climates in workplaces, in our homes, everywhere else, in the education system, embracing linguistic diversity as part of our diversity is a piece of that. And that's where we need to be curious about how do grammars differ from group to group within English in the United States and around the world. And it doesn't mean that you can't, as a teacher, and I am a teacher, you can't signal to students. Some people will notice this as not the standardized form, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. You're helping students make informed choices as they navigate the space. And that's what I hope that this book can also help people do.
I think that's a perfect place to end on, actually.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
It was so lovely to talk to you.
So much fun. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, I'm glad you could make it. And we always leave our listeners with one final message.
Don't be an asshole.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.